Is that better? All right. Thanks, Thomas. I'll try again. So last week we left you with a prompt about precepts and suggested you spend some time reflecting on it over the week. If you weren't here, that's okay. You can spend some time reflecting on it now. And then if you would like to share your reflection, Thomas will bring you the mic and you can tell us about it. So the prompt was, which precept or precepts help you most in your interpersonal or internal relationships, including your own relationship with your own body, speech, and mind? Anyone have a reflection to share? Donald?
Yes, this is Donald. So thinking about that this week, feel like don't praise self, blame others come up a lot. Also, don't blame self as part of that. And it's just something I try and think about. I don't know. I like to look for fault in things. I like to try and always have tried to do that. And a lot of times it's on myself, you know, whatever. And just kind of focusing on that precept kind of helps me see past that and kind of realize what is actually going on in those situations. And it's nobody's fault. So yeah, that one's been working with me recently.
Thanks, Donald. I find that a fun pastime as well. And by fun, I mean easy to fall into. Any other reflections? Jen?
I have really liked thinking about do not kill in a more subtle metaphorical way and working with like in a meeting, if someone brings up an idea and somebody else immediately is like, no, blah, 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 like that, like subtle, like ending of an idea and the effect that that has on the group. And like, I found ways to sort of think about that in my own relation to myself and in relationship to others. And that's been very interesting.
Nice. Thank you very much.
This is Patrick. Is do not be dishonest one of the precepts?
Sure, yeah.
Great. That one then. I've been a people pleaser my whole life, and I've had this habit of like projecting onto people what I think they want. And not like outright lying, but sort of presenting a manicured version of reality. And I realize that that sort of robs both of us of having an authentic relationship. So it's been uncomfortable at times, being honest, but really rewarding.
Thank you, yeah. Kyle.
It's going to take me a little while.
We heard you need to get some extra steps for
My name's Kyle. Do not dwell on past mistakes. It's like a, it's, I feel like it's easy to like just think that, but then realizing like what happens if you don't dwell on past mistakes. I don't know. It comes up for me a lot like with presenting actually. Like I've noticed like if I like make a mistake and end up thinking about that and like focus on it, then like it's just like a cascading effect of more mistakes. So like thinking about that, I like to think about that a lot and then like expand it and like stretch it out. Like just living every day and like what happens if I like dwell on a past mistake or like a mistake that I recently made or something, and how that could like affect the rest of my day. It just comes up for me a lot, with presenting, and it's nice to like reflect on that like regularly.
Thanks, Kyle. Well, for that, I felt it viscerally as a fellow precenter. And also, yeah, thanks for sharing your precenting practice with us. All right, I think it's time for Colleen to say something.
So tonight we're going to be looking at the paramitas. And the word paramita means perfection. Paramitas are virtues or character qualities that are associated with and practiced by bodhisattvas in their endeavor to save all beings. This is a primary Mahayana teaching. And so in our tradition, we practice with six paramitas. The other traditions, including oh, there they are. Sorry. Thanks, Vanna. Other traditions, including Theravada, have different and sometimes longer lists of paramitas. And I find it really interesting. Like, it's not like it's our six with four more tacked on. It's like they kind of get jumbled up a bit and reconstituted into a sort of different set. But anyway, we practice with six, and that's what we'll be talking about tonight. And so that word perfection might sound intimidating when I think about it. I'm like, perfection, huh? Perfect, huh? Their practices, and there are also some antidotes to obstacles and difficulties that we encounter in practice. And I find them super relevant in daily practice. We're just about to sing a song about the paramitas and getting to the other shore. And, you know, we continuously experience dissatisfaction in the forms of irritation and longing and depression and et cetera, et cetera. And these paramitas are tools. They're an offering of tools for us to work on all of these dukkhas and experience liberation. So that's our topic tonight. And with that, Gabe, will you come and join us up here? Everybody has us. If you have a songbook nearby, page are we? 31.
If you don't have a songbook, they're at the back of the room.
Do you want to sit on this side with your, yeah, that's probably a good idea. Switch. Oh, yep. Here we go.
Wanted to just bring people's attention to, it's one of the last, I think the second to last verse. There's a line that says, face that wall and shout out Anna. And that's an opportunity to actually really shout, which the kids love. I think it's good.
Paramita, there's nothing sweeter than a little paramita. No, we want to get to the other shore, but don't think about it, just paddle your oar. First time I'm
Now, Daga, you want to come on up and join us as well, and and so, yeah, now we're going to each give a little mini talk on each of the candidates. So, Reggie's going to begin with Donna.
That's Donna Paramita.
Sure.
Okay. So, Donna, first Paramita. My term vow, this term is about Donna, and I'll say more on that in a literal minute. And for that reason, I wanted to do this one. I asked to do this one. I chose this term vow because over the spring and summer, I read several books that were sort of secretly about the Paramitas, and probably not actually secretly, I just didn't look closely enough, but in the books, Donna was presented as the groundwork for all the other paramitas. To understand and practice Donna completely is both a foundation and a doorway to practicing all the others. So what is Donna? Donna is typically presented as generosity or giving. There's three different types of Donna: the Donna of giving material goods like food or money. Cloth is another traditional one. There's the Donna of offering the Dharma. And finally, there's the Donna of offering fearlessness. This last type, the Donna of offering fearlessness, is the one that my particular vow is about and that I've been working with this term. And it's been a pretty interesting thing for me to work with. I see it both as expressing my own fearlessness of not being afraid of anything, or rather being with the fear when it arises, and also, and importantly, of offering fearlessness to others when they are in my presence so that they can say and do what they need to without fear. One of the things that's come up for me in working with this is a lot of clarity around what I am afraid of, which is sometimes pretty scary to see really clearly what I'm afraid of. And looking at my fears really directly and with a lot of clarity so that I can experience fearlessness within that fear. Secondly, it's really viscerally informed me of what I read in those books about Dana of any of the three types really being a basis and a groundwork for working with other paramitas. I've sometimes been surprised at what has come up as useful for working with Dana. One particular thing from one of the books that stuck with me and has been helpful in working with this term is a story from one of the books I read. The book was Entering the Mind of the Buddha by Reb Anderson. He is one of the teachers at Green Gulch. His story is that he was given a gift of a very cool pen from someone, maybe a student, and he shows his wife the pen, and she also admires the pen and thinks it's very cool and asks if she can have it. He realizes that he's feeling stingy about sharing the pen and he doesn't want to give it to her. He notices that he's up against the Dana of offering material goods. So he decides to practice with a different kind of generosity, a different kind of Dana, and offers generosity to his stingy feeling. He tells his wife, no, he's not willing to give her the pen. And he tells himself something like, oh, you, hello there, you stingy feeling that doesn't want to share the pen. It's okay that you are here. He offers generosity to the stingy feeling. The story finishes when the stingy feeling, having been seen and offered generosity, fades. He ends up giving his wife the pen. I like the idea of offering generosity even to the most unpleasant versions of myself, whether or not it means I eventually feel like giving up the proverbial pen. That's what I have to say about Dana right now.
I'm next. I'm going to talk a little bit about Sila. Pretty short, actually. So Sila means ethical conduct and moral discipline. Sila here is broad and encompasses all of the precepts, which we looked at last week. For me in my practice, the idea of Sila sometimes comes up in daily activities, like at work or, you know, interacting with other people. Sometimes I don't think of a specific precept off the top of my head, but I often ask myself, is this decision or idea or action or whatever, is it ethically and morally sound? And when I ask myself that, I'll have a gut response to that, and I know the answer. So that's kind of how I practice with Sila, and I'm able to kind of use Sila as a little bit of a shortcut to thinking about the precepts in that way. Thich Nhat Hanh also talks about Sila as being about mindfulness training, and he goes on quite at length about that. And I do think of, like, that's kind of what I'm doing when I take those moments and consider whether, you know, the morally, ethically soundness of a decision or something I'm going to say or whatever, before I do it, or probably more often after my words, thoughts, and actions happen. Sila can also be an antidote to all of the poisons, greed, anger, and delusion. So, you know, we practice Sila in order to dispel some of those big, angry, greedy, deluded things that happen. And now we're going to go on to Kshanti.
That is correct. So I was told 4 minutes max for this stuff. So I was really self-conscious and I decided to try and keep it really brief. So it might be briefer than what you guys are saying. So Shanti, you know, when I first came to Zen practice about like 35 years ago at another place, not this one. And, you know, what I was looking for was a really big experience. I wanted something for me. And these kind of virtue or morality kind of lessons were okay, I guess, but I kind of viewed them as a side dish, you know, and something like a list of paramitas or such seemed like a religious relic, you know. So it took a long, long time before I started to see the value in it. And so I guess that's a plug for Shanti, patience, you know. It's like, you know, actually transforming sufficiently to see that these are summaries of the fruits of practice, right? So Shanti has like more than one definition. If you look it up, patience is the primary one, but forbearance is another. And actually, I've even found forgiveness as another one. So, you know, obviously patience is essential to practice. If you think Zen is a quick fix, then you're in for a rude awakening. You know, it's going to take time, and it comes in fits and starts. And you know, there's a couple steps forward and then a step back, and diversion and every other kind of thing that can really stretch practice out over the long term. So you really are in it for the long haul if you want to start learning something from practice. And you know, if you stick around a sangha long enough, you start to notice that the people who've been around for quite a while, sometimes years or decades, handle their lives a little bit differently than do people who are newer to the practice. There's definitely an effect that shows up in people who've been steadfast and patient. Forbearance, right? So if you look that up, you know, that's foregoing your own sort of short-term gratification for like a longer-term goal or for the greater good. And I find it kind of an interesting thing to talk about self-control in the context of Zen practice. Because as we try to get a grip on self, you know, we start to learn how diaphanous and how we use the word empty, but how shifty and temporary it is. And so as self starts to disintegrate a little bit and you kind of release your grip on it, the withering of self, the whole idea of control starts to become a little less important, right? So with less emphasis on self, there's just less need to control. Instead, you have the option to engage life as it is, as it comes to you, right? To be able to say yes, to say yes to all the different forms in which life arises. And the last one, forgiveness. And I don't know if there's anything really that could be said to be more healing than forgiveness, you know, in terms of your relationships with others and with yourself. You know, usually forgiveness benefits the forgiver more so than the one forgiven, if the person who's forgiven even knows that they have been forgiven. And as I've practiced, I've realized, you know, a little bit more and more with each year or each decade that passes, this ability to just kind of what might have been considered an infraction at one time and generated perhaps an array of petty grievances, just can almost pass right through you as though it's you know, it's like you're forgiven even before the words are leaving your mouth. Yeah. And that's a very peaceful feeling. It's really beneficial to relationships. The opposite of forgiveness, of course, is blame. And that is one of the most acute forms of suffering and inertia that you can encounter. Yeah. Anything else on this paper? Let's see. I'm out of time. Get the hook. All right, so I have a failure to let. How long do I have to draw it out? No, I'm good.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And next up is Reju about Virya.
I think I just experienced the shadow side of Virya I'm about to talk about.
I mean, a little bit. Certainly not no patience, John.
Okay, so Virya. My personal strongest association with Virya is Fudo, who's over there. Fudo is standing in the flames of burning karma on a small pedestal from which he cannot step off. He's holding a sword to cut through delusion, and he's also holding a rope to subdue the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. He's wearing this really fierce face, and he's got these sharp, pointy teeth. One sticks up and one sticks down, like a jack-o'-lantern. And he is one of our Dharma protectors. So you can go look at him some other time if you want. So Virya is translated as energy or effort, determination, perseverance. And when I hear those words, what I immediately think of is actively doing stuff and not falling asleep. And one of the hindrances is sleepiness, and the prescription for sleepiness is to arouse virya. So that's why that connection. I'm not sure what I think about that translation. It's not often how virya appears to me, and it's not usually like a burst of energy or activity anyway. Yesterday, I had this brief conversation with Jiko about virya because I was sort of having trouble connecting with it, and I thought it might be useful to talk to her, and it was. And she reminded me about the shadow side of virya, which can show up as a sense of righteousness, like a sense of, I'm right and you're wrong and get out of my way, like stop talking, die guy, it's my turn. Justice is an aspect of virya, and it can be taken in that direction toward anger and hatred. Not anything like justice can just, you know, it's a thing that can go in multiple directions. And one of them is toward anger and hatred. And in that sense, it's a lot more familiar to me, especially given various world and political events, but also in terms of things like where spatulas of various sizes go into the kitchen. And in those cases, I do get a burst of energy to like put the spatula in the spot where it belongs, to yell and protest and take action against things that I perceive as unjust. And sometimes I'm skillful in discerning there, and sometimes it's useful and reduces suffering, and sometimes it's really not, and it's just kind of messy. But it does awaken me. It does enliven me. I do get a burst of energy regardless. And I'm going to come back to Fudo, because in the course of the conversation with Jiko, she asked me why I have such a strong association between Fudo and virya. And it's because he's standing in these flames of burning karma. He's just standing there, not moving, just steadfast. And boy, howdy, that takes a lot of energy just to like stand there while all this like burning flame karma is up around me, just to sit and watch these karmic patterns flare. And the action here, the energy there is not visibly and externally moving, but of being really immediately present with what's difficult and uncomfortable. And that is also intensely awakening. Yes.
I'm up next to talk about jhana. So jhana means meditation. We call it zazen. We sometimes talk about two. Well, actually, I took that part out. Never mind. Never mind that sentence. We don't talk about two things. For the most part, we talk about zazen as just sitting. When we're starting out, in order to learn to focus our zazen, we may learn to count or follow breaths or notice a sensation of breath on the lower lip or something like that. But, and so those are like to help us focus and help us like kind of learn to do just sitting. But ultimately, what we're aiming for is just sitting. Dogen says that zazen is not meditation practice. It is simply the Dharma gate to joyful ease. So I really like that. The Buddha taught that there are levels of jhanas, meditative concentrations. And the first four, the first four are known as the four jhanas. The first is characterized by joy and well-being. The second, so these are like, you know, meditative absorptions that you might experience. The second is deeper and more peaceful, no longer discerning or reasoning. Those have been abandoned for a profound sense of unity and joy. The third jhana involves equanimity and mindfulness, a physical well-being and concentration. And the fourth is a state of pure awareness beyond pleasure and pain, and a neutral, clear-minded state of equanimity. So what's my experience of jhana? I've been practicing zazen for over 30 years. And I will say unequivocally, I just described those to you, but you're not gonna, like, don't make that a goal to sit down and experience those, because it will never happen. I've never reached them by aiming for them.
I've never reached any state of meditation or zazen by saying, I'm going to get to this state of meditation. So I'll go back to that part about just sitting. I find that the most, for me, the most fruitful zazen, the most fruitful jhana usually happens in a sesshin or retreat-like environment. And it, again, it happens when I just sit down and I don't chase after anything. I'm able to stop chasing what happened in the past and, you know, stop thinking about what's going to happen in the future and literally just sit. So that's my experience of the wonders of jhana. Jhana also is an antidote to stress, anxiety, and a wandering mind. So take advantage.
Thank you. Prajna. You know, so in Buddhism, we talk about skillful means or expedient means. And wisdom is that faculty that allows you to do that, right? And it's like, I'd never had done that Paramita song before, but the little stanza on wisdom, really, it really does, is kind of what encapsulates what I would say. You know, it's like, if you're...
Got it.
If they don't, right? And so, you know, wisdom is a...
Sorry.
It's okay. So wisdom is a thing that is available to everybody, right? And it's more like something recognized or remembered than it is like something that you acquire or build or create over time, right? And that's, I think that's the most important aspect of it. You know, as you try to act skillfully in the moment, trying to do what you can to foster a wholesome outcome, right? You have to look to some sort of resource that you have that is not a playbook, right? You can't expect to rely on a script, right? And you can't expect to have a method by which you, you know, steps that you take or anything, right? This is something you have to, that you have to sort of get out of your own way in order to have access to. And it certainly improves the relationships we have with others, you know, by loosening our grip on the idea of self, right? Really helps a lot when, fostering consideration of others, your behavior becomes more thoughtful and more generous when wisdom is allowed to flow. It's like I gave a talk on this topic in here on a Sunday back in August. And one of the things that it really occurred to me when I was thinking about, as I was writing the talk and I read it to everybody, was that we have access to something and something has access to us. And that's what it feels like. It feels like a two-way street, right? Sometimes it feels like a deep well, a resource that's available, but it doesn't feel one-sided. Right? It feels like a relationship that you have with wisdom. And I don't understand what it is or how it comes about, but you know it when you see it, and you are fortunate enough to be able to channel it and have a positive influence on the people, the beings around you. Okay, good.
Thanks, Daigai. All right, we now have a little bit of time for some discussion. Yes, please, Vanna, if you can turn over the next letter. So we're offering these, and Thomas, we'll need you to get at the ready as well, offering these discussion questions. But if you have other thoughts or comments about the Paramitas or questions about anything we talked about, this is an opportunity for that. So these questions that we're offering, which of these Paramitas resonate with you? Which seem especially hard or confusing? And which would you like to dedicate some practice to? So, or anything else about the Paramitas that you'd like to talk about?
Have a kind of a question about Virya. You described it as energy. I've often thought about it or heard it described as effort. Yeah. That one resonates with me, especially like the sense of like the right effort, like what's the
right amount of effort and not going too far and being too effortful, but that there is a little bit of effort that is needed.
You have more to say to that?
No, I think that adds to it. But
I have often also thought about it as effort, and I like what you said about got to give some effort, but it's right effort, right? Yeah.
Gabe has a hand up.
I just had to break that unbearable silence. I appreciated the example, Rachel, you gave from Reb's book. Because it does seem like, and I think you were sort of pointing to this as well, Cohen, that like just the term perfections, it so easily can kind of look like a list of like, here's how I should be, but I just, you know, I'm constantly failing to kind of, you know, achieve these or apply these, or maybe I can at times and then other times not. But I liked kind of that sense of, in that example, like applying a certain quality to whatever the experience is in the moment. So if the experience is, you know, stinginess or impatience or whatever it is, it's sort of like sense like these are qualities that we can bring to bear in that moment with whatever's happening, and as opposed to I need to overhaul my experience in the moment. Just appreciated that. I wanted to name that.
Thanks for sharing, Gabe. I like that as well.
It's Donald. I feel like with resonates right now. I feel like Donna is really resonating with me. I feel like it's something I try and practice with without even really realizing it. Reggie or anybody else up there, could you speak to, you said fearlessness, and Donna, could you just speak a little more to that?
Yeah, I'm happy to. Like I said, it's my term bow to practice the Donna fearlessness. And so there's sort of two different ways in which I'm seeing it. And as with many things in Zen, they're sort of just two different aspects of the same thing is what I'm seeing. And so like the first way that I understood the Donna of fearlessness is that I'm giving my own fearlessness. Like I'm not afraid of anything. I'm just very brave. And yeah, I think that's part of it. And like, what do I have to be brave about is an interesting question. And here's an example. I have a yoga teacher who really likes to give hugs, and I do not really like to receive hugs. And I decided that I would ask her not to hug me anymore, but I was afraid to do that because, you know, she's offering the hugs from a sense of like warmth and affection and connection. And I didn't want her to feel rejected. And I like had this whole like, well, it's not so bad. Like I can handle a hug, and, you know? And so like I was like, I'm having a fear response right now. So if I want to offer fearlessness, the thing that I want to offer is telling her that although I appreciate the warmth and affection that she's offering, I don't actually want the hug. And so that allowed me to step like into my vow and be fearless about like sharing that with her. And she accepted it in a totally kind and normal way. So that also like builds my sense of fearlessness. Like I can actually tell people what I need or want and they won't reject me or get mad or yell or whatever. So that's one way I've been working with it. Another is like offering fearlessness to others who come to me. So maybe I'm doing something that someone is like, that sort of makes me uncomfortable. I don't really like it. And I wish she wouldn't do that. And like my hope there, is that someone could come to me, as I did to my yoga teacher, and say, hey, you're doing this thing, and I think it's probably, you know, out of a sense of
this or that or the other, but it's really not landing on me well. And I can say, oh, yeah, of course, I get it. I can stop doing that. And without like inspiring in them a sense of fear of rejection, or like, I can't tell Reiju things, or like, I can't get my needs met in the face of who this person is. So those are sort of the two aspects of that. Does that help?
It does. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And then just super quick question. Does the order particularly matter for the Paramedias, like the way they're presented? I always see them kind of presented in the same order. I'm just curious if... Because I know the precepts, there's kind of a loose reason why they are the way that they are, but...
I haven't heard a specific reason why they're presented this way. I have you? Okay. Sorry.
That's probably the answer.
But I mean, I do, you know, Reiju mentioned that it was in the book. I don't do you remember which book, but anyway, that, you know, all the books, a couple of the books, that Donna is kind of the basis for all of them. So, you know, that's a good way to look at it. But again, you will find them, even these six, worded differently. You talked a little bit about the different words for Kashanti, and Thich Nhat Hanh has like a whole jargon, a whole different kind of jargon for them. I mean, they're the same, and you know, and yet he developed his own kind of paradigm, I guess. So
I see you doing this.
Circle, circle. Yeah, like the Eightfold Path. Yeah, I mean, today I started thinking about how many of the Paramitas are also pretty direct correlations to parts of the Eightfold Path, you know. Yeah. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We love our lists and our numbers.
Can I say one thing of about course. Fear? You know, fear is an interesting thing. You know, it used to be something I was afraid of, and now I don't mind fear so much, you know? And so fear is still around, you know, but there's a fearlessness about fear, right? And that's, fear can become an object of study, right? And you can hold it and feel it without having it be something that you panic about or try to escape from. It's like, so fear's not gone, yet it's like somehow become toothless. Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon, and I don't know, it's I guess kind of maybe not what I would have wanted, you know, a long time ago. I think I would have preferred just to have no fear at all, but I don't think that's ever going to happen, a completely fearless life, but no fear of fear. Yeah.
My name is Mark. So I saw the longest time my impatience as a type of, in some ways, a virtue, because I got stuff done. You know, I would just jump on it and get it done and not wait. And if there was a, you know, one weekend to enlightenment, I would sign up right away. But I've come to recognize how, you know, in its own way, almost like addictive. It's like, oh, I'm not doing something. I can get on my phone. I can do this. I can do that. And the unpleasantness and difficulty and in a futility of it. And so learning to sit, even just sitting for a half hour, is like, and just working on sitting is a challenge. And I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for sharing. That's nice. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for sharing how you're practicing with Kashanti right now in this moment. maybe any one final comment before we wrap up for tonight?
I guess I was thinking about myself, the idea of giving seems the most accessible to me. And I can't remember which sutra it is, but there's one where I think the Buddha tells a story about stinginess, and basically concludes that that's like the biggest barrier, the thing that he gets most frustrated with. And it seems like giving is such a accessible thing to me. Like, I can think about jhana, and I can think about prajna, and I can think about, wow, it's like, those are, but giving is like, yeah, I know what that is. It's really accessible. It's really easy to access and do. Just give something, you know, boom. And for me, that's why it's on the top of the list. Like the first one on the list. It's like the lowest hanging easy fruit.
Thanks for sharing. All right. We're going to go ahead and wrap up. I have a couple things that I have to remember to say. So first of all, next week, next Wednesday, there will not be a class because it's the day before a holiday and lots of folks are traveling or spending time with family. So instead, there will be a double sit. So you're of course welcome to join for that. So there will be a class the following week, so 2 weeks from tonight. And part of what I'm saying here is my appreciation and gratitude to all of you. I won't be here for the last class. I've really, really enjoyed spending this time with you on Wednesday nights. And I'm sorry to be missing the last class. But Reiju will be here with Kakumio. That's 2 weeks away. And shall I tell what the topic is? Yeah, the topic is going to be bodhisattvas. Took us a little while to arrive at that, but there you go. The topic is going to be bodhisattvas. And so finally, I'm going to give the prompt for 2 weeks from now, which is, again, reflecting on these paramitas. So that prompt is, how do you see the paramitas, one or a collection of them, working in a particular relationship, including a relationship with yourself or other people that you're close to? So that's your prompt to consider, and come back in a couple weeks and share about that. All right, we'll get ready for Vespers. Thank you.